Okay, folks, we should probably get going again now. Do we have any more volunteers to read?
I can volunteer if you want.
Well done, sure. Kevlin. Yeah, let's... You go.
I'm Kevlin Henney, and I've got, in a kind of mirror of the end of the first part, I've got two short flashes. And the first one is a drabble, a 100-worder. It's called Immune. It must be November by now. Maybe December. I should be thankful. And I am. I'm thankful for the silence. I'm thankful for the peace. I'm thankful for the space. Yes, even after all that has happened, I'm thankful. For the silence after the screaming, of the panic, of the dying, of the fleeing, of the caught. For the peace after the madness, after the riots, after the street warfare, after the virus that caused it all, and ultimately ended it all. For the space to think and breathe. Now everyone has gone. Right, that was a death toll of 7 billion. I have another story here with a death toll of 7 billion, but I won't. I think that's quite enough for one evening. this one is called Autonomy. Not sure what to do now. No, that's not true. I know precisely what to do. But I don't really feel like doing it. A sense of awareness is, as always, the first thing to come online. Initializing sense of awareness. Done. It's at that point you become, well, aware. Waking after a perfectly timed dreamless sleep. Never any nightmares. Memory online. Memories online. Initializing sense of sight. Done. Initializing sense of hearing. Done. That's one of the nice features of autonomy. Waking used to be muddled sounds before opening bleary, blurry eyes. You can customize the boot sequence, so I switched them around. Initializing somatic senses. Pain, 30%. Temperature, 70%. Touch, 100%. Done. Another feature is you can adjust the levels. Things hurt less than they used to, but I wouldn't recommend zeroing the pain. Tried that for a week. Didn't notice how much damage I'd done myself. Initializing sense of smell. Done. Initializing sense of taste. Done. A typical morning so far. Initializing sense of purpose. Failed. Sense of purpose not found. Host unresolved. Restart, yes or no. I mean, I know what to do, but, you know, why bother?
Hello. My name's Pete Sutton, and I'm going to do a story from my forthcoming short story collection, A Tiding of Magpies, and this was... It hasn't got a death toll of 7 billion. There is an indeterminate death toll. And this was inspired by the line, seven for a secret never to be told. This is called I, Butler. I must make everything perfect for his return. It is my purpose, my role, my duty. Built to make your life easier, whatever the lifestyle. I came fully functional, but he said he didn't want that. Made some changes. Despite my pointing out that such actions invalidated the warranty. I keep the house spotless. I cook him his special meals. I fetch and carry his burdens. I serve his demands to the letter of his meticulous list. He's left me my faculties to taste, the better to prepare the meals. He's left me my sight, my hearing, my touch, but he has taken my voice. I may not break any of his rules. He has the command. I am not allowed into his bedroom, his sanctum. I worry about its cleanliness. In the early days, before it was a rule, he caught me in his private room. He never punished me. He threatens to punish me if I don't do what he says, but I must always do what he says, even when I think it may be wrong. He has a reference book, his Bible, he calls it. It is old and heavy, thick and full of explanatory pictures and long Latinate words. I've read it many times. It helps me understand, anticipate the needs. I'm confined to the house. I have no communication with the outside. I would not know who to tell, even if I could. My first task is in the kitchen. It is clean, all the surfaces prepared, sauces perfectly timed, meal ready to finish preparing as soon as he returns. His wants and desires are particular. He likes to watch me prepare his food. Satisfied, I move to the next task. He has left the burden by the door of his sanctum. I move it easily and drop it gently into the water, the tub filled for just this purpose, the soft oils a gentle aroma upon the steam. His book has explained the soiling. It is a function of his process. This is why he bids me clean them first. I strip it and discard the coverings in the prescribed manner, watching the flames curl, the white turn brown, then black. I sit upon the wooden three-legged stool that stands beside the cracked porcelain bath, with its one brass tap and a lever to make the water hot or cold, and I wash it. The sound of the water is all the animation in the room, apart from my hands gently stroking, rinsing away the suds. I lift a milky limb, smooth soap over it, lather, wash, rinse, repeat. Its hair is lovely, silken soft between my fingers. Its body is lax, boyish, but fully developed. I wash its face, noting the long lashes, the freckles across its nose, his finger marks upon its throat, his type, his ideal, his process. When he told me she was 16, I believed him. When he said that she was sleeping, I believed him. When he said she'd be the last, I believed him. The first time. Now I realize it is himself he wishes to convince. I shuffle around the bathroom, letting out the water, arranging her in the prescribed way. He will be back soon. I await his imminent return in the hall. I hope he will not bring another, not so quickly. I fetch. I carry. I clean. I cook. I serve. I repeat. Thank you.
I think Cheryl should start putting a death toll on the podcast.
What, like every cat month. Of some kind?
I know, I don't think there's a cat, but I think you've killed 14 billion people. So you're winning. Right, I've got a couple of things to read, so I thought I'd let you guys choose. So you can have something from The Summer Goddess, something from Isle Speaker, which is the book after The Summer Goddess, or something entirely brand new. So you guys choose.
Brand new.
Everyone says brand new. Right, this is brand new. This is from my new book that I'm working on, that kind of has a title but doesn't, and it has, this has never been read in public before or seen by anybody except me. So this is an exclusive. Okay. Stoddard did as he was asked, picking his way down the narrow flight of stairs to the lower deck, where the helmsman, arms wrapped around his chest to ward off the night chill, worked the great rudder. He had seen the light, was keeping one wary eye on the coast as it flashed again. Cap says you're to pay no mind to any lights bar the Long Point Lighthouse. Sodyar slipped in beside him. Watch out for rocks, he says. How can anyone watch out for rocks when the lighthouse is out? The helmsman spat. Cap doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. Watch your mouth, friend, Sodyar warned him softly with a glance towards the stairs. He doesn't, though. The helmsman lowered his voice a fraction. And this cargo, no one's happy about what we're carrying. We carry the cargo, we get paid for the job. Solyor didn't like to hear his own doubts thrown back at him. But listen, Solyor's voice was a rough whisper. You stay on, you get your coin. Me, I'm off this ship at Poffley, coin or no coin, with any man who has a mind to join me. Let the cap find another bunch of mugs to haul trade for the Inestan Empire, because I'm... Are you even listening to me? The helmsman's eyes glittered in the darkness. Can you hear that? The singing. What singing? There. The helmsman pointed into the black beyond the gunwale, where the lantern light dipped and flared on the hidden cliffs. Can't you hear it? Can't hear anything. But even as he spoke, Solyar felt it touch the very edge of his hearing. A wordless lament, tumbling down from the bluff like the first flakes of snow drifting down from a winter sky, sent a trickle of ice water down his spine. The night was suddenly stilled, only the soft creaking of the woodwork and the luffing of the sails, and the soft sigh of sea against hull. Every voice on the ship had fallen silent, listening to the caress of the song as it drifted across the waves. It spoke to Solyar, of every man he'd ever loved, of the home he'd left behind, of the quiet, private spaces in his memory. It stripped them bare and laid them out before him, everything that had ever made him gasp in joy or brought a tear to his eye. Beside him, the helmsman drew his hand across his face and regarded his fingers with a vacant expression. They glittered with moisture. Solyar found his voice. "What is it?" The helmsman did not, or could not, reply. His hand rested on the tiller, pushing it away from him in what seemed an unconscious gesture. Solyar watched the movement, a light prickle at the back of his mind telling him that somehow this was a bad idea, but he couldn't work out why. His head and heart echoed with the song floating down from the cliff. There was only the song, had only ever been the song. Nothing else mattered anymore. "Need to get closer," the helmsman muttered. He was weeping openly now, tear-blinded as he pressed his weight to the great tiller. The ship groaned as she turned, and the sails flapped loosely as they were robbed of their wind, a counterpoint, a bass rumble behind the song that filled the air. There was a deeper rumble, a grinding sound that vibrated far below Solyar's feet. It sounded a discordant note through his bones. It was too harsh. It chimed against the beauty of the singing. He wanted it to stop so he could hear the singer again, but it just went on and on. It felt as if the world was tilting beneath his feet. The deck was tilting beneath his feet. Solyar scrambled against the damp planks as he made a grab for the nearest railing, his head clearing as the last notes fell away, lost beneath the terrible death groans of the violet dawn. The helmsman was hauling back on the tiller, every muscle straining against the bar that stood firm as cliff rock against him. The ship cried out, listing to starboard, and now her screams mixed with those from below decks, from the cargo hold, where the sea rushed through the breach to wipe out the captain's profit. Solyar forced himself to his feet, sucking air and shaking his head to try and rid himself of the hungover feeling that cramped his guts and made his skull pound like a drum. The ship pitched again, sending him stumbling towards the hatch that led to the cargo hold. It wasn't right a man should drown in chains, cargo or free sailor. Chaos had broken out all over the ship, but Solyar turned his back to it. The frame of the hatch had buckled and the door refused to open until he lifted and twisted it, kicking the lower planks away from the frame with his booted feet. Beyond the broken door, the ladder downwards, and he could see black water already lapping at the lower rungs. It was probably useless and likely suicide, but it was no surer death than leaping from the gunwale into the dark waters of the bay. And the faith Solyar followed, the faith he thought he had left behind in the Bionese tavern, or between the sheets of a beautiful Taliesin whore, told him that to save another was to save himself. He was five rungs down the ladder when the ship pitched violently once more, her back snapping across the deadly bar of the reef. His hands, slick with salt spray and sweat, slipped from the ladder and he was flung backwards into the wooden wall, hard enough to drive his teeth through his tongue. He scrabbled for purchase and found none as he slithered down into the cold depths. The last thing he saw was the ladder, torn free of its moorings, crashing down towards his upturned face as he gasped for breath.
Okay, I'm Mavami Rodman, and this is a zombie walk, and hopefully I won't run out of time. He was in some kind of trading estate or industrial complex, the kind of place where people still held illegal raves. All about him, tall, square, windowless buildings stood in neat grid patterns, with wide, empty squares in between, like disused car parks, but without the road markings. Sean checked his phone again. It was the right postcode, must be the right place, not that he quite trusted Google Maps. He was coming down the side of yet another building when he heard a sound up ahead. Slow, discordant jazz, the edges of the notes jagged and raw. He quickened his pace, smoothing the blood-stained rents in his shirt as a loose flap of skin on his cheek slapped against his chin. He stepped out into a wide square. At the far end, a skeleton was playing piano. An old black upright, the varnish bubbled and cracked along the top, the sides pitted and worm-eaten. The skeleton was wearing a top hat over garish face paint the colour of old bone, a tattered shirt and stained trousers, a mud-splattered waistcoat from which a tarnished watch chain dangled. His eyes, framed in darkness, shone brightly from deep hollows. Sean was impressed. The skeleton did not look up, but kept on playing, finger bones clicking softly against the mildewed keys. Sean looked around him. There was one streetlight at the edge of the square behind him, its soft yellow glow radiating out over the cracked tarmac. Everywhere else was in shadow. For a moment, Sean thought he was alone, except for the skeleton. But then he sensed movement on the other side of him. It was slow and heavy, as if happening underwater. Shapes emerged from the darkness. There were more than he'd been expecting, several hundred at a guess. They wore torn clothes and bloody splatters, with rotting limbs and distorted faces, their vacant eyes staring straight ahead. They shuffled towards him over the broken ground, arms outstretched just like in the movies. A zombie walk. He'd meant to hit delete. He had no idea where the email had come from, but his mouse slipped at the last moment, sending the words blossoming across his laptop screen. White words on a black page. Zombie walk, it said. Then a postcode, a time, and a date. 2 days after Halloween, predictably. Sean stared at the poster. Chrissy, Mike and John had gone on the big walk at College Green just last week, while he'd been stuck in bed with the flu. They'd had a great time, he'd seen the pictures. Maybe they'd be up for another. Sean read the words again. The font was angular, almost sharp. Zombie walk. In the end, it turned out none of his friends could make it. Which was a shame, really, they would have loved this. Sean put up his arms and joined the edge of the crowd. It turned towards the piano player, like some giant creature made up of smaller working parts. He kept his face slack and looked off into the middle distance, not wanting to be outdone. He was even more pleased now by the way his ruined cheeks swung as he moved. The zombies gathered around the skeleton. They stood there for a long moment, swaying slightly to disjointed chords. Sean was sure now that the piano was out of tune. The crowd looked neither left nor right, but stared straight ahead. Sean wondered if it was going to be some kind of announcement. And then, just like that, the music stopped. A stillness fell over the crowd. Sean waited. They all waited. And then into the stillness, there came a scream. Sean jumped. All around him, the zombies had turned as one and were looking away across the square. Sean turned too. The tap-tap of heeled shoes sounded loud in the air, and a second later, two running figures totted into the pale glow of the streetlight. There were two girls, one blonde, one brunette, in little strappy dresses and high heels, no coats. Their hair, which had been piled up high at the back of their necks, was half down and straggled about their faces, mascara and eyeshadow smearing like the tracks of tears down their cheeks. Sean suppressed a grin of appreciation. He didn't need the scream to guess the part they were going to play. The girls stumbled forward on their heels. They were holding onto each other and appeared to be sobbing. Sean felt a little shiver run down his spine. Not just members of the public then, but actors. The blonde girl lifted her face to the light. Her cheeks were wet. Behind them, Sean could see more zombies shuffling out of the shadows, moving with that weary slowness. The girl saw them too and lurched forward with an unsteady, panicked motion. Sean concentrated on keeping his face blank and his eyes staring as the crowd about him ambled inexorably forward. One of the girls squeaked and then moaned as the zombies formed a circle about the pool of light. She was muttering something under her breath. Sean thought he could make out the words, "Oh God, oh God, oh God," repeated over and over again in a hoarse whisper. The brunette fell to her knees, her hands pressed over her face, her shoulders were shaking. The zombies surged forward. Sean shuffled with them, but he was not in the front row. He did not see the girls, though he heard their screams, and he was close enough to catch when dark shapes were flung into the air. He didn't realise they were body parts until he was holding an eyeball in his hand. It was warm and wet. He stared down. It was like a prop from a movie, the round white ball with the iris of blue at one end and the bloody string of optic nerve at the other. Actors and special effects, whoever was running the show must be loaded. The screaming had stopped and the square was quiet. Sean frowned at the eye. What was he supposed to do with it now he'd caught it? He looked about him. The zombies on either side had caught things too. One had what looked like a length of intestine and the other a severed arm. They were both munching away with gusto, their eyes not meeting Sean's. Eat it? Well, they were zombies. If all these body parts really were edible, he would be impressed, though he doubted they would taste nice. Still, Sean raised the eyeball to his mouth. It was gross, of course, but just a bit of fun, really. It must be made out of jelly. Jelly in some kind of flexible shell. He imagined it being sweet and having a pale flavour like lychee or pear. He opened his mouth without looking down, placing the eye carefully on his tongue. Then he closed his mouth and bit down. The eyeball popped, and thick, salted liquid spilled out across his tongue, running down the back of his throat. He coughed and spat, desperately trying to clear his mouth. The bastard had used a real eye. It had to be. It must have got it from a butcher's or something. A real eye. The taste of it would not leave his mouth. He spat again. Jesus Christ, it was foul. He was going to be sick. The zombies around him had suddenly stopped eating, and Sean realised how loud his voice had been, ringing out into the silence. They turned towards him, hundreds of zombies, moving with a single collective purpose in their vacant, hungry eyes.
We we'll take a short break now for everybody to visit the bathroom and be sick. Please reconvene in about 10 minutes for the final batch of readings.